This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Online shopping and banking, social media sites, smartphones and tablets, and ever-growing free Wi-Fi networks have provided us with an amazing amount of freedom and convenience. Unfortunately, it's done the same for criminals. Malware, email phishing schemes, massive data breaches at national retailers, and just plain old theft. More than 3 million smartphones were stolen in the U.S. last year, putting our most personal and vital information at risk. October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and joining us to identify online dangers and to share tips on how you can protect your information are Dave Hatter, solution architect and partner with Definity Partners, and Phil Horney, Director of Technology at the Northern Kentucky University Met Center. Thanks to both of you for being here this afternoon.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
Thank you much.
Dave, there have been a lot of big cases of internet crime in the news, major retailers being hacked, big banks being compromised, and it seems like something that you hear or read about almost on a daily basis. Is this really as huge of a problem as it seems?
Yeah, I think it really is as huge of a problem as it seems, and it seems like increasingly the problems just get bigger. You know, there's been a Target hack recently, a Home Depot hack, and what's really interesting about this is the attack vector the hackers are using isn't the typical one of let's probably break into their servers and steal from the database. They've inserted malware into the point-of-sale systems through some remote backdoors. I know this sounds like mumbo-jumbo, but they're basically, as you swipe your card, able to capture that stuff on the front-end side, and apparently it's very difficult to detect. So yeah, it's a major problem. And it's something consumers need to think about before they go out and buy things with credit cards.
And not to mention the good old-fashioned property theft and internet crime have that devious relationship going. Millions of smartphones that were stolen in the U.S. last year. That's compromising a lot of personal information as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I hate this topic because it sounds so scary. And, you know, technology can be a really powerful tool that does a lot of good things. But unfortunately, it can also be used because these hackers and identity thieves know that regular folks don't understand all the inner workings of this and frankly don't want to. They just want to do what they want to do. And I totally get that. And they're able to, unfortunately, take advantage of that to do all kinds of nefarious bad things.
It is scary. But if you're prepared for it, you're aware of it, you can take steps to counter it, can't you?
Yeah, that's the big thing is education and awareness and knowing how to mitigate some of these risks.
And additionally, a lot of the cell phones now, are especially Apple products, are coming with encryption turned on, whereas in the past with the older versions of the Apple software, encryption was not off. You had to physically go in and turn it on yourself, and a lot of people did not know how to do that. So you lose your smartphone. It's very easy to crack that four-digit login code just with trial and error.
Phil, what are some of the common tactics that are being used by these criminals?
Well, there's so many different factors. I mean, you can have just your smartphone stolen. There's credit card skimmers that go on ATM machines. So you could use an ATM machine and have your card skimmed and have your number stolen that way. Internet pop-ups. There's just so many attack vectors. And the one goal of all these folks is to make money.
Well, the goal is to get information that they can use, right? To steal your identity and thus make money off of that, correct?
Exactly. They want your credit card number. They want your personal information so they can steal your identity and use that to get credit cards and things like that in your name and use that to get money.
A really interesting tangent on that. Yeah, Phil hit on a lot of the ones. Phishing is another big one. Clickjacking. He's right. There's so many different ways they can do this. And again, they prey upon the fact that regular non-technical dorks like us don't know how all this stuff works. And they don't want to have to know this stuff. But, things like when you get right down to it, there's a recent report that health information is now worth more on the internet. Someone would rather steal your health records than your credit card. And that's partially due to the fact that banks have very advanced fraud detection, generally speaking. And if someone steals your credit card and they detect unauthorized, unusual activity, they're going to find it pretty quickly and can shut it down. Whereas if someone can break into a hospital and steal your health information, they can go perpetrate Medicare fraud. They could potentially buy equipment or drugs in your name. Hospitals at this point and health organizations in general don't have the advanced technology to detect this fraud, so they're able to potentially extend this kind of thing for years before it's detected. And a recent report said that hackers are willing to pay roughly about 10 times as much for someone's personal health information as opposed to their credit card. It's crazy.
Phil, let's kind of break this down. Let's start with the most common device that people have, which is the smartphone. What are some good ways to protect that?
Well, the best thing is just to have physical security. You know, keep it somewhere that it's safe. You know, don't leave it in your purse where it could be seen or in your car. I would say probably about 90% of the thefts occur in your car because you left it out and someone could see it there. Turning on encryption on the device, those are really the biggest ways to do it.
Using some kind of password or swipe code or something. A lot of people just leave these things unlocked because it's inconvenient, and that will go a long way towards this. And I agree with Phil's point on physical security. You know, if you lose an old school flip phone or something and it's got some phone numbers in it, well, that's probably not that big of a deal. But if you're doing business with some kind of device and it's got sensitive confidential customer information or your own financial information in it, there's a much greater risk there. So, yeah, being sure that you know where it is and taking care of it and not leaving it lay behind where someone can walk off with it or steal it out of your purse is critical.
You know, Dave, this one drives me crazy. Emails that look like they're from someone you know. And the only way I can usually catch those is just by gut feeling. I say, why would this person be sending me an email at this particular time about this particular topic? How do you avoid that kind of a scam?
Well, a healthy dose of skepticism is key to this, as is education and awareness. What you're referring to is a concept known as phishing, typically. And it could be some kind of macro virus sends out emails to try to propagate itself, a worm kind of thing. Or it could be an organization. And there have been many local organizations, you don't have to look too far, that have been hit with this. An organization that appears to be a bank or something purports to have sent a mail to you and they want you to log in because they need your username and password or your account's going to be shut down. So in my mind, there's a couple of red flags, and it'll be interesting to hear your take on this, Phil. You know, gut is always good, but misspellings, funky wording, or any kind of urgent action you need to take right now or some terrible thing is going to happen to you is almost always a tell that it's some type of phishing attempt and you should not do whatever it's asking you to do.
I mean, I treat every single email like it is a fraudulent email. Unless it's something I'm expecting, if I see an email in my inbox from my bank, the chances of it being fraudulent are pretty high. Generally, the bank, unless you're doing a lot of online banking, is not going to send you something that says, oh, hey, we need your password, because they already have your password.
That's right.
They don't need it from you. So when you see things like that, or you see somebody sending you a file that you weren't expecting, treat it like it's false.
Yeah, go in and assume that it's probably something bad. And two other quick tips I would throw into the mix. Even if you think it might be real, do not click on any links in it. Go to the organization that purports to have sent it and either call or email them. You initiate the contact instead of the other way around. And I would also say, to Phil's point, you know, assume that it's probably false. And if you follow up with them and confirm that it's real, that's one thing. But no reputable bank or any kind of financial organization is going to ask for a username or password in an unsolicited email. And if they do, you need to find a new bank.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation about internet security. My number one most hated scam, Dave, is the fake warning or security alert message that you get on your computer that's just a scam designed to break into your computer. And these are tricky because they can look pretty real. How do you counter something like that?
Well, that's a really good question, Mark. And that's the problem with so many of these things. These folks have gotten good at creating things that look very realistic, and many non-technical folks don't realize how simple it is to create something that looks realistic. So you're surfing the web and suddenly a box pops up and it kind of looks like it came from Windows and it's warning you've got these viruses or whatever and they want you to click this or do something like that. Again, if it's not something you recognize, like you happen to know that you use Symantec antivirus, anti-malware software, and it's something from them, then you should automatically try to get out of it as fast as you can, because it's either going to try to install some malware or it's going to try to sell you something, or possibly some combination of both.
Now, when you say, you know, try and get out of it as quick as you can, I tell people, do not click on anything that pops up. Because the button that says, you know, cancel does exactly the same thing as the button that says okay, and the close button too. So I tell people, just log off, don't click on anything. Just log off your computer, it'll close all your windows, and then just log back on and continue where you were.
Yeah, that's really good advice, Phil. You're right.
You know, it's like whack-a-mole with my kids. As soon as they see a pop-up, they want to click on it. And that just, you know, causes problems.
Phil, what about apps that can actually shut the phone down or wipe it if you lose it? I mean, how do you... What's
well,
your
like,
advice for dealing with apps?
Like Apple, you know, you have the Find My Phone feature where if you lose your phone or whatever, you can remotely wipe it. But with apps, I don't know. Maybe Dave's got some thoughts on that.
Well, there's, you know, like I've got a new Samsung phone. It has a Find My Phone feature. There's also, if you set the phone upright, and unfortunately this is going to take a little bit higher level of skill than probably most people have, but like because we have a corporate account with this, you can set it up through Verizon. We use Verizon to be able to essentially install policies on the phone and dictate how the phone can be used, as well as wipe the phone remotely. So the Definity Partners corporate administrator of all of our phone accounts could go in and say, hey, Dave, you're fired, and wipe my phone remotely. Or, oh, Dave, you pinhead, you lost your phone again. We better wipe that thing.
Right, and that's all on the corporate side. On the home user side, almost all of the carriers have protection that you can purchase for a monthly fee. So you can do things like for your children's phones, you can block certain functions. Like I have my kids' phones set up so that they can only call myself or text myself and my wife during school hours, and then after hours, it's open. So your carrier probably has features like that that you can enable for a monthly fee, which is a great idea.
Yeah, so Verizon, Sprint, whoever, check with the carrier. They'll typically have all kinds of additional services. Many of them you have to pay for, but there's a lot of cool things you can do. You just need to be aware that they're out there and check with your carrier.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. Let's talk with Nick in College Hill. Good afternoon, Nick. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good, thanks. How about yourself?
Not too bad. I have a friend of mine who had suggested one time when you come across something suspect like that you can open it in something like AVG that would be able to detect any kind of a malware or a spyware. Do you have any information on that or something that you might be able to put forward on that?
Well, AVG is a free antivirus software tool, and it's a pretty good one, I think. There's several free ones out there. It's one of the more well-known ones. I would tend to go in Phil's direction, however. If you install something like AVG or Symantec, typically the software is running all the time in the background looking for virus malware-like activity. The problem is the hackers know this, and they constantly change the things around or come up with new stuff. And the anti-malware software is only as good as its most recent definitions. It only knows what it knows. So I would tend to agree with Phil that if something pops up, you're not sure what it is, if you have any kind of question about it whatsoever, your best bet is to, I said close out, you know, close the browser, or to Phil's point, log out and shut the computer down, because the antivirus software may or may not be able to handle it.
What if you were to actually open that particular email with AVG versus having it running in the background as it's supposed to do? He had told me that what you should do is open that actual email with AVG.
Well, I don't know if AVG supports opening the email directly, but if you have an attachment, you'll want to download it to your desktop. And as soon as you do that, AVG should scan it by default. Most virus scans have an on-demand feature where you can just right-click on the file and say scan with AVG or whatever virus scan of your choice.
But the problem is, if I could just throw out there, even if you have the most recent updates from AVG or whatever Microsoft, whatever you're using, it may not understand that particular new attack that has been sent to you, and it may or may not be able to detect it, and you could infect yourself doing that. I personally would not do that.
Nick, thank you for the questions. Right. We appreciate it. Now, Dave, this is a term that you sent my way that I'd never heard of before, clickjacking. What is clickjacking, and how do you counter that?
Well, clickjacking basically is a way, and it's perpetrated in different ways, but ultimately what it boils down to is you get a URL that looks realistic. Usually this is part of phishing, okay? And, you know, the bank purports to need your password, and they want you to click a link. And a lot of times,
okay,
if you mouse over that link, you'll see that it doesn't actually point to Citibank or Fifth Third or whatever. I don't want to single out any banks here. So the links don't go where they purport to go. And unfortunately, if you just casually click on them without looking at where they're going, and that's, I want to point out for folks, most of the time you can put your mouse over a link and it will tell you in the browser window or in your email client, depending on what you're using, where that link is going to go. And if it doesn't line up, like if it looks like it came from a bank and where the link points does not line up with that, you should definitely not click that link. And you should contact the bank if you think this could be real. So it's a technique basically to try to send you somewhere else, and in many cases somewhere that looks very realistic, but unfortunately is some kind of hack. There's a very interesting Dropbox hack recently that did something like this.
Yeah, and a lot of these malicious sites steal the graphics off of the site that they are purported to be. So let's say you bank at PNC Bank, and you know you're used to going to their website, and you get an email that says, "Hey, you know, click here to you know, log on to your account and you click on it, it probably will look exactly like the bank website because they're stealing those graphics. So if you do mouse over to the link, usually at the bottom bar, it'll show you the URL that it's going to. And a lot of times they even fake those so that they look like they're, you know, more legitimate. Like it might say pncbank.something.ru. And you know, well, it says PNC Bank at the front end, but the whatever.com or .ru, that's somewhere in Russia. I don't want to click on that.
Phil, what about the cloud? It's a great idea for storing lots of data, and it can be a backup in case your personal device gets stolen. But just how secure are these cloud services? I don't know that I would feel comfortable putting really sensitive information about myself in the cloud.
Well, the cloud providers, you know, their business is providing you with a service. And if they do a terrible job of that and, you know, leak your information or make it easy for hackers to get on there, they're going to lose your business and they're going to, you know, go bankrupt. So their goal is to provide the best service and the best security that they can because, you know, it's a pretty rich market. There's a lot of providers there. You could go anywhere and get your cloud. But typically, I think the cloud is pretty secure. You know, a lot of these hacks that, you know, people are stealing photos of celebrities and that, and they say, oh, well, that was a hack on the back end. I think most of those were really just password hacks on a weak password. And a lot of these celebrities, maybe they're not using a strong password. So it's easy for them to crack and get on that.
Speaking of passwords, how do you create a strong password?
Well, it gets harder and harder to do simply because as computers get faster and hackers get smarter with their tools and technologies, it's more difficult to have a password that meets the criteria. But sort of the old school general rule of thumb would be you want to have at least 8 characters or more, and you want to have a mixture of numbers, letters, and symbols, and it needs to be something someone couldn't easily guess about you. Now, if you apply all of those things, that usually means you come up with a password that is very hard to remember. And it also means that you should not use the same password across multiple sites because once they get one, then they've got them all. So typically my advice to people would be try to think up a word or phrase that's at least 8 characters long and then replace the letters and numbers where they make sense or the letters with numbers or symbols. Like, for example, use the at symbol instead of the letter A or use the number 1 instead of the letter L or the number 7 instead of T, things like that. So that it's not a word or phrase that's easily guessable or hackable. There's dictionary programs where literally it will test every word in the English language against your password in seconds. So I'm saying as computers get faster, they can do this faster. So something that can't be looked up, something that's not easily guessable, and something that can't be generated easily by a computer will go a long way towards keeping you secure.
Now, with dictionary attacks, they're looking for like a single word password. If you string several words together, and you can include punctuation. A lot of people don't realize that you could just type in a sentence and have periods and commas and exclamation points in there, and that would satisfy the complexity of a better password. String a couple of words together, 3 or 4 words, make a sentence, include punctuation in it, and that will give you a very long password with several dictionary words that even if they tried to hack, you know, 4 dictionary words, they're, what, 450,000 words in the English language. Trying to go through 4 iterations, that's a lot of cracking.
But also then it would be fairly easy for you to remember because it's something you know. That's usually the balance point. Most people don't want to do all the stuff that Phil and I are talking about because it's too hard to remember this stuff. But if you can come up with something that you can remember and use these techniques, it'll go a long way to make that simpler for you to use.
Dave, should you allow your browser to remember your login and password for a site or is it better idea to just type everything in every time you go in?
Well, my personal opinion on that is it really entirely depends on where you're using it. If you have your own device, mobile phone, tablet, PC, or whatever, and you pretty much have exclusive access to that and can control the physical security, as Phil mentioned earlier, I don't see a big problem with it myself. If, however, on the other hand, there could be multiple people using that device, or especially if you're in any kind of public environment like a public library or anywhere where there's common computers for people to use, that is a very, very bad idea because potentially anyone could log on as you and do whatever they want to do.
Yeah, see, I'm of the opinion that saving any browser password is a bad idea. You're better off writing it on a piece of paper and sticking it in your drawer than saving it in your browser. I mean, the chances of somebody coming into your house and stealing your sticky note with your password on it are much less than somebody in Russia hacking your browser and stealing your passwords.
Dave, with more and more kids using tablets and laptops for school, how do you best protect them? How do you teach them to protect themselves from these kind of tactics?
Well, Mark, I think you've probably, that's the $64,000 question. I don't know that I have a good, simple answer to this. I think it's really tricky because I think most kids have no idea. I mean, even compared to adults, kids have no idea what risks there are out there, how difficult it can be to secure this stuff, how permanent the nature of what they're doing is nowadays. You know, as a general rule of thumb, because we could probably talk about this for hours, I think it's education awareness. It's warning them about the dangers. It's telling them what to look out for. It's potentially using tools like Phil mentioned with your carriers to try to lock down certain functionality and block access to certain things. But, you know, it's an ever-shifting landscape that changes very quickly. So it's very hard to do. What do you think, Phil?
Well, I think for cell phones, tablets, all these devices have cameras on them, sometimes multiple cameras, and you know, a lot of those can be activated remotely. There was a couple of scenarios where a school had loaned their kids laptops and they remotely went in and turned on the cameras while the kids were at home using them to check and see if they were doing homework. So the best thing is just to, you know, disable the passwords or disable the cameras. If you're using a phone or a tablet, go in and set up the restrictions yourself. I mean, get that phone or device from your kid, wrest it out of their hands.
Good luck with that. Easier said than done, right?
Get the password from them and set up the restrictions yourself. Put in a code for that. And
if you feel like you don't know how to do that, it's too much. I mean, there are people that can help you. You know, you could go to somewhere like a Best Buy or go back to where you bought the phone and say, hey, I heard Phil tell me about these restrictions. I don't understand how to do this. I need help. There are people out there that can help you, but you have to even know the questions to ask. So I think Phil makes a good point there that it can be done, but it's tricky.
Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Dave Hatter, solution architect and partner with Definity Partners, and Phil Horney, director of technology at the NKU Met Center. You can find links to more information about protecting your online information at wvxu.org.